Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined tonight for a discussion of Guardians of the Galaxy by my favorite talking tree, Eric Esperschlager.
I am unoriginal.
If you are listening to us for the first time, you should visit our website at fthismovie.net, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, we're at fthismovie, email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. You can find us in the iTunes store by searching F This Movie, but it's only our 99 most recent episodes. So to find all of our 200-plus episodes, you have to go to fthismovie.net. And I'm excited to announce that for the first time as of this week, we are now available on Stitcher, which I believe is a popular app that people use to download and listen to podcasts. So if you have been wondering when we are getting on Stitcher, the wait is over. We are now on Stitcher. I don't know how to use it. I don't know what to do with it. But have at it if you are a Stitcher fan.
Welcome, Stitcherers.
We're going to be talking about Guardians of the Galaxy, spoiler-free for a little while, and then we will get into spoilers, and we'll let you know when that's going to happen. But before we do, Eric, I have to ask, have you seen anything good lately?
I knew you were going to ask me that, Patrick.
I know. I'm unoriginal, too.
Well,
we are unoriginal. See what I did?
I did see what you did do there. Anyway, first thing I caught was a movie that I first heard about from you. I think you wrote a review of it when you saw it at some sort of fancy critic event. But now it's on Amazon Instant Prime, and it's called I Declare War.
Ah, yes. What did you think?
I liked it. I liked it a lot. Maybe not as much as you did in the heat of the critical film festival moment.
I did watch it again, and I still liked it because I was wondering that too. Like, is the bloom off the rose? But I watched it a second time and was still as big a fan of it.
Yeah, no, it is really good. This is a movie about a group of kids who are out in the woods pretending. Well, they're playing war, quote unquote. They're pretending with fake guns and it's kind of a capture the flag situation. Although the movie shows what they kind of see with their imaginations, which are that they're carrying real guns that fire real bullets and real explosions and stuff. And it was interesting because I saw the synopsis on Amazon for it, and their synopsis even seemed to be a little confused because it said that the kids were playing paintball in the woods, but. My understanding is that they had just kind of taped together sticks and guns and things. They weren't actually shooting paintball rounds, as far as I could tell.
No, they weren't. They had balloons filled with paint, but that was it.
Right. And there's a pretty efficient way of kind of setting up the rules of war during the opening credit sequence, which I really liked because there is this kind of idea, the sense that you know there is this kind of established game that they have. This there are rules of war. This is this serious thing, and the way the movie switches back and forth between kind of the reality of what they have, which is just not real weapons, and what they imagine the kind of the real weapons, I think isn't just a clever little gimmick. It actually I think speaks in a pretty powerful way to the way kids play, and kind of just how seriously kids take everything. I mean, it's a movie about the way things are things that are pretty minor in real life, or kind of in the grand scheme of things, are deadly serious to kids.
Right.
And some of the motivations of what happens and some of the things that happen in the movie are about that. I'm not going to spoil anything, but I did really enjoy it. I thought maybe it kind of peaked halfway through, but I thought it stuck the landing pretty well.
I'm a big fan of it. I think I had it on my top 10 favorite movies of last year. Mm-hmm. I remember just being really impressed at how it takes what is essentially a very simple premise, just kids playing war in the woods, and uses that as a way to address a lot of, I thought, bigger things. Like you said, the way kids play, like gender roles, like mm-hmm. first loves, like religion, I thought, like movie violence. I mean, it presents some images that feel very transgressive, and then you have to stop yourself and say, okay, but no, that's just their imagination. They're just playing. And then you have to take two steps removed from that and say, oh, wait, but all movie violence is just pretend. Like, mm-hmm. it was fascinating, I thought, the way it kind of played with some of those ideas. So, yeah, I was a big, big fan of it.
Sure. I mean, you can kind of take what happens in the movie, and if everyone was aged up by 10 years, it would just seem like a regular war movie.
Right, exactly.
And none of that, the violence and the language and all of these things that feel a little more kind of, so in one sense, you know, real for kids, but also kind of, you know, dangerous or, like you say, transgressive, is kind of just because they're putting it in the context of kids playing. But it has just as much to say about, I think, the real war as it does fake war. So, yeah, I did. I definitely enjoy it. I enjoyed it. And people can check it out very easily now. So they should.
Yeah, cool. I'm happy to hear that that's on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
I actually, not to interrupt it because I want to hear what else you saw, but I just heard, and I can't confirm this, maybe I'll confirm it as we are speaking. I had just heard that a movie I talked about, I think on maybe last week's show or 2 weeks ago, a movie called Enemy with Jake Gyllenhaal. It's the newish Denis Villeneuve movie. It is on Amazon Prime for free if you are a subscriber. I highly recommend that everyone check it out. It's one of my favorite movies of this year. So that I had just heard that it was available on there now, and so I wanted to give it a plug and tell everyone to see it, and then have them respond in the comments to this podcast when all of their heads have exploded. It's good, that kind of movie.
Good. Well, listen to the podcast first, because we're going to lose listeners very quickly.
Exactly,
your heads are exploding.
Yeah. So what else have you seen? I'm sorry.
No. I mean, I think this next movie is easily as important as Enemy, I'm sure. And that's 1980-something's Big.
Oh, yeah.
I went back and watched Big. We were on vacation a few weeks ago down.
You found a Zoltar machine.
I found a Zoltar machine. I'm actually
like, finally,
serious.
I get the references.
we were down in a series of beaches in Delaware. We were down there with my family and my wife's family, and we were walking down the boardwalk, and we walked past this one little arcade, and I saw a Zoltar machine, and I said, hey, look, it's a Zoltar machine. And my wife said, what? And I said, haven't you seen Big? And she said, no. So I tracked it down. So we watched Big.
Wait, did this actually happen?
Yeah, there was actually.
I was joking about seeing the Zoltar machine.
Nope, there was actually a Zoltar machine.
That's fantastic.
It wasn't exactly the same. I don't remember it saying Zoltar speaks. I think it just said Zoltar. Who knows? It may have been like a after the fact thing. I don't know where these Zoltar.
One of those famous
brands.
Big merchandising tie-ins.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I think it probably came in a Happy Meal or something. but yeah, no. I didn't try it, but I saw it there, and I was like, oh, we should watch Big. I remember that being. Okay, and I didn't expect a whole lot. It's still pretty fun. I mean, Tom Hanks is great, so I will watch him in most anything. It's a weird movie, though. I mean, if you like step back even like half a foot and look at it, it gets real weird real fast.
Because he's dating an adult woman. Yeah,
I mean, there's the whole kind of statutory rape angle. That's weird. Even the fact that she's like attracted to him, or that he gets a job in the first place, when he basically is acting like someone who's on the spectrum. I mean, he's acting like someone who's maybe you should not have sex with them. I mean, hey, good on him. He was real happy when he came to work the next day, but it just seems like that first night when she takes him home because she wants to. Further her career, it's just the way he's acting makes it seem like maybe you don't. I don't know.
Anyway. Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's a whole like aspect of like his mom thinking that he's been kidnapped and just the trauma of that. And when he comes home, like if there was ever a sequel to that movie, it would just be the police investigation. It would just be like
Elizabeth
police, like,
Perkins behind
him.
Bars.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that would all, because she's like standing there watching him go into his house. I would imagine that the police are hiding in the bushes and they pop out. So on second thought, I want to see Big 2 because it sounds awesome.
Still Big?
Still Big. No, I think it's Big House, maybe.
I haven't seen it in such a long time. I feel like I feel like I could definitely watch it, obviously, just based on the Tom Hanks performance. But if it was anyone else, I don't know if I would have any interest in revisiting Big.
I think that's fair. It's like it's still like fun in that 80s comedy kind of way, but it's just the basic premise, the fact that they felt they had to put in a love story for someone who was 13, really. I mean, it's 13. If he was like 15, 16, well, something like that,
13, right,
just seems a little too it's sweet, and then it's not sweet. But Big. So the first time I'd gone back to see Big, and the first time in a long time I saw a non-anamorphic widescreen DVD.
Ooh, nice. Little window box action.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure if I prefer – I'm not sure if that's better or worse than full screen now. Like full screen, I will. There was one point I was trying to get. I forget what movie it was. I was getting it from the library, and I kept requesting the widescreen version, and they kept sending the full screen version, and I sent it back every time because I'm cheap, but I'm not, you know, that cheap.
Right.
I don't know, but I guess that's a problem that I have.
Anything besides I Declare War and Big? I'm sensing a theme in what you've been watching.
Kid stuff?
Yeah, mostly kid stuff. Yeah.
Oh, that's true. I didn't see that. No, I don't know. No, not really a theme. I revisited Avengers kind of partly because I wanted to catch up to see the end tag again.
Right.
To this movie. And partly because I hadn't gone back and rewatched it successfully since it was in the theaters. I think I tried to start it a few times and just sort of bailed.
I think I've done the same thing.
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed it. I mean, I made it all the way through. I think that the character interactions are still really great. I think that you know, still a lot of the dialogue is well observed. I think that the final set piece is still a lot of fun to watch. But it kind of speaks to a larger problem that I've had, which is just I find it very hard to either go back and watch Marvel movies or want to go back and watch Marvel movies. And I don't know why. I mean, the best I can think of, and this is something I've been considering recently after I read someone somewhere describe the Marvel movies, you know, less like a series of you know, film sequels than as sort of like a TV show, like episodes in a TV show.
Right.
And that kind of makes sense to me because I never go back and rewatch individual episodes of a TV show.
Okay.
Does that – I don't know if that's nuts or if that's – but for whatever reason, I don't really want to go back. I've seen them. I like them when I watch them, and then I don't really want to go back, with at least one exception that we'll be talking about tonight.
Oh, I'm excited.
Yeah, it's Captain America.
Is the so the first half hour of Avengers is still a mess? I didn't imagine that.
It's not. It's just hard to kind of get into it. There's not a whole lot that happens in the movie, really. Like, if you break it down, you know, Loki steals the Tesseract. Yeah. They capture him. He, you know, all the stuff happens, and the more stuff happens, and then they get together, and they kind of, you know, it's a movie about getting the band together, much like Guardians is. But the first half hour is kind of hard to kind of get into.
It's a mess, and I enjoy the movie, and there's a bunch of stuff about it that I like, but I suspect my feelings about it are pretty similar to yours. I rewatched Revenge of the Nerds a few weeks ago for the first time since I was like 11 or 12, as long as we're going back and rewatching stuff from our childhood. That was I don't think it was the first rated R movie I ever saw, but it might have been. It was definitely the first like on-screen nudity that I ever saw because I was sleeping over at a friend's house and I was not allowed to see it. But of course, I was a rebel. And so we watched Revenge of the Nerds. I don't know. I think of like those kind of 80s comedies, this sort of raunchy kind of sex comedies. You know, I still have never seen Porky's, so I can't speak to how good that movie is. I don't know how I've managed to go my whole life and never see Porky's, but go figure. I think Revenge of the Nerds holds up pretty well, and I have to champion especially three performances. Robert Carradine and Anthony Edwards are both really, really great as the two leads, and Curtis Armstrong as Booger. I had tweeted out, I think the night I watched it, that Booger is one of the greatest movie characters of all time. And I stand by it. That is a fantastic character and a fantastic performance, and one that he had no interest in playing. It's interesting to watch the supplemental stuff. Because I bought the Blu-ray. It was like $4 or something at Best Buy. And if you watch the supplemental material, everyone involved with the movie talks about how they didn't want to do it, how they were embarrassed to be a part of it, how they didn't even want to tell people what the name of the movie they were working on was until it kind of blew up and people saw that it was working. And now, of course, they've made like 3 sequels, and Robert Carradine and Curtis Armstrong host a show about being a nerd on TBS. Like, they've basically made it their life's work. But at the time, they were both very embarrassed to even be a part of it. I saw a movie called Liberal Arts, which came out last year in very limited release, and it is the second movie from writer-director-star Joshua Radner, who most people would probably know better as Ted Mosby from How I Met Your Mother.
Oh, yeah.
He had made a movie a couple years ago called Happy Thank You More, Please, and, of course, invited the comparisons to Zach Braff, because here's this guy on a sitcom, and he's making this kind of quirky indie movie. And Happy Thank You More, Please, you know, as the title would suggest, has some nauseating indie quirk to it. But there's, like, some genuine humanity, and I came away from it hoping that he would make another movie, a better movie, like, once he had worked certain things out of his system. And so he made this as a follow-up, and I'm glad that he's, you know, hopefully going to keep making movies and cranking them out and just try to sort of refine his voice and find himself as a filmmaker. But I thought Liberal Arts was a big step backwards, basically. He plays, a 35-year-old guy who goes to visit a friend, Richard Jenkins, who's retiring from his job as a professor. And he meets Elizabeth Olsen, who is, a 21 or 22-year-old college student. And she, of course, falls instantly in love with him because there are at least 3 different women throwing themselves at him in this movie, because that's what happens when you're the writer-director. it was fascinating as I watched it because it reminded me a lot of a script that I tried writing when I was about 20. And I don't say that as a compliment at all, because I outgrew all of those things. Like, when I was 20, I thought that was good. By the time I was 21 or 22, I realized, oh no, this is not good. So for Josh Radner to still be writing that script, in his mid 30s, is not high praise. So it's not a very good movie. I'm sorry to report.
That's too bad. Well, at least he has How I Met Your Mother.
That's right, and that terrific finale. then I'll talk quickly about 2 movies I saw. I spent the last weekend in Austin, Texas for the first time. My wife and I went there for our 10th wedding anniversary, primarily so we could go to the Alamo Drafthouse and see Guardians of the Galaxy, which we're going to talk about in just a minute.
Feel free to give us kind of the travelogue approach. Let's just talk about the movies. I mean, I think, I've never been to Austin. I assume it's named after Austin Powers. I mean, am I right at least about that?
It's named after the 3rd Austin Powers movie, which would be Goldmember. Is that what that – we saw Guardians of the Galaxy in Austin, but while we were there, we were able to sneak in 2 more movies. Sunday night, we caught a repertory screening at the Draft House of A Fish Called Wanda, and it was the first time I'd seen it in a long time. It was the first time my wife, I think, had ever seen it all the way through. Are you a fan of that movie?
I haven't seen it in forever. I keep meaning to go back and rewatch it, and I will probably after tonight. Depending on what you say next.
I know. I think it really holds up. And again, maybe that was just, hey, I'm on vacation, and hey, I'm in this audience of people who are enjoying this, and hey, they're showing this on 35mm. I'm at the Draft House. There's all these things working for it. But, it essentially has just 4 performances at the center. It's John Cleese, Jamie Lee Curtis, Michael Palin, and Kevin Klein, who won the Oscar for the movie, which very rarely happens. They don't usually hand out Oscars for comedy. And all 4 of them are very funny in very different ways. I just think it's a really great movie. I think it's dated a little bit by a terrible music score, which I did not remember. There are some odd kind of filmmaking choices, some zooms and things, and again, a bad score that, to me, date the movie. But other than that, I would say, it's one of the better comedies to come out of the 80s. Kevin Klein and Michael Palin in particular can't open their mouths without making me laugh in that movie. And finally, we caught a repertory screening of The Philadelphia Story, which, again, I hadn't seen in a couple years and Erica had never seen. And that's just a terrific movie. I'm a big, big fan of that movie, and that was maybe my third time seeing it, and certainly the best time that I had seen it. And it was interesting, before the movie started, a guy came out, they showed it at this beautiful theater called the Paramount. And before they showed it, the guy came out, the programmer came out to introduce it and said that Robert Osborne had been there to introduce something a couple years ago and talked about how there were all these stars of the 30s and 40s and 50s. They get emails and letters at Turner Classic Movies about all of these different actors. And the ones they get the most letters for are Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart, both of whom are in the Philadelphia Story. And he said that for some reason, Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart sort of transcend the time period, that they still feel contemporary to audiences today, whereas somebody like Clark Gable or Gary Cooper sort of feels stuck in their time period. Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant still feel relevant. And as he was saying it, I was sort of nodding along, like, yeah, that's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. And I've never thought of it that way. And I don't know why that is. Do you agree with that, or do you care to expound on why that might be? I know I'm just springing that on you.
Yeah, but. No, that's right. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, Jimmy Stewart is such a, okay, this is a terrible phrase. He's kind of an everyman. I mean, there's something about him that's very, relatable even now. I mean, maybe it's 'cause he feels like he could be your dad or something.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know about your dad specifically, maybe, or my dad, but someone's dad. I assume he was. Anyway, but yeah, I don't know. There's something very kind of fresh and I don't know. There's no like barrier. There's no cultural barriers, it feels like, between their performance and the audience now. A lot of older movies can feel, you know, just kind of a little bit out of sync with modern sensibilities. But I think their performances, especially, I think, still play. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know why.
Yeah, I'd be curious to try and get to the heart of why that is. In the Philadelphia Story, I get it, because both of them are so sort of sharp and funny and sarcastic in a way that does still feel very current. You know, it's still a style of humor that people are using today. But, you know, the same can't be said of Katharine Hepburn, who's acting in the same movie, but is giving a performance that feels sort of mannered and dated in a way, because it's Katharine Hepburn and that's the only performance she knows how to give. And I say that as somebody who, you know, doesn't dislike Katharine Hepburn, but
there's certainly like an old style of acting that is a little bit more put on.
Right.
And neither of them feel like they're putting anything on when they, you know, when they act.
Maybe that's what it is. Yeah.
Maybe they feel just more like, you know, real people.
Yeah. And I would actually add Gene Kelly to that list. I think you could watch a Gene Kelly movie now and it feels like it still feels very contemporary, even though he was acting in a style of movie, primarily the musical, that has, you know, sort of gone out of fashion. But his performances, I feel like, always feel very relevant and contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
Enough
about old movies.
Let's talk about Guardians of the Galaxy. Because I think I can speak for both of us when I say that this was our most anticipated movie this summer.
Yes, possibly of the year. Although I'm not. Well, there are probably some other smaller things I haven't seen that I didn't think I'd be able to see in the theater. But yes, of the summer, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, my expectations were very high, and not just, you know, this was before all the crazy positive word of mouth started coming in. It was based on, you know, the trailer looks great, and both you and I are big fans of James Gunn. I've been following him even since, you know, his Troma days, when he wrote Romeo and Juliet and co-wrote the Lloyd Kaufman autobiography, which I've read probably four times. I just love that book. So it's been really interesting to see, because I remember when he first got hired to write Scooby-Doo, and I was like, oh my gosh, the guy from Troma is writing a Scooby-Doo movie. And now here he is at the helm of a Marvel Comics movie that had the biggest August opening of all time and is mostly universally praised. So, with as crazy excited as you were to see the movie, I know you were listening to the soundtrack in the lead up. How did the movie stand up for you?
I really love it.
All right.
And yeah, I mean, it's hard. It's hard to go into a movie with that much hype, and walk away, you know, blown away. And I have to admit, now I will say up front, I've seen the movie twice.
Nice.
And I actually planned, I almost never go to see movies in the theater twice, partly because it's very difficult to schedule that kind of thing. It's been a long time, at least since before we had kids, that I've been able to do that. I kind of planned my weekend, knowing, okay, well, I'll see it on Friday. I've scheduled out this time of the evening. I can see it on Friday. And if I want to, my local theater is going to show it again on Saturday night. I could go, I could not go. I'll play it by ear. And I went to see it on Friday. I really liked it. I think it's another one of those situations where I really liked it the first time, but kind of felt like maybe there's a little bit more to get if I saw it a second time. Saw it the second time, and it really clicked even more than it did the first night. I think it's pretty great. And I know some people have some nitpicks. I think this is not really a movie for me that I'm going to nitpick that much. I think it's pretty great. Great, great, great.
I certainly don't want to lead off by saying like, oh, well, I have some nitpicks, but there are things that I was like, oh, okay, yeah, this part doesn't work or this part isn't as good. Ultimately, I don't totally think that matters. I mean, that really only plays in if you want to get into a discussion about like, is this a perfect movie? Is this the best Marvel movie? You know, then you kind of have to start weighing some of those things.
Sure.
But I thought the movie was a ton of fun. I thought it delivered on the expectations that I had. I thought it was so great to see James Gunn working on this scale, but not losing who he is as a filmmaker. There's still so much James Gunn in the movie, and that's great to see a movie like this, this big space opera summer movie that still has, you know, a strong sort of authorial voice. I had a ton of fun with it, and it's, again, I feel like we've been fairly lucky this summer when it comes to some of our blockbusters. I think there's been five or six kind of summer movies that are good in the way that you want a summer movie to be. This was maybe my favorite of all of them, probably my favorite of all of them. Some of that is just because it speaks to some of my sensibilities, maybe more than some of the other movies, but so much of it is because it's a movie that just really, really goes out of its way to be very entertaining and doesn't sacrifice character. I think it was last week's show on Dark City where I had said, you know, the more movies I see, the more I kind of figure out what works for me in movies and what doesn't. And I think I'd come to the conclusion that one of the things that I really look for in movies are well-drawn characters. And this movie had a bunch of them, almost too many, which would probably fall under sort of the nitpick category, because I feel like there's some collateral damage in this movie, some characters that don't get their moment, but they're not the ones that matter. I don't feel like any of the central characters really got the short shrift. I had a ton of fun, and I do want to go see it again. I saw on Twitter that you had seen it twice, and I was like, oh no, it's going to be the world's end all over again, where anything I say, you're like, well, I'll see it a second time.
I will try very hard not to do that.
And I don't mean that in like a cocky way, but it's no, because you're coming at it from sort of a more informed place where you've been through it twice now, and you could see the way certain things hold up or pay off in a way that I couldn't.
I will say this. The first time I watched it, I thought it was maybe a little overstuffed, a little unwieldy in places.
Okay.
Second time I saw it, I did not have that complaint.
Okay.
I think that the way the story is set up, the way characters are set up, the way things are not necessarily foreshadowed, but the way ideas are introduced early on that pay off later in kind of subtle ways works very well. I think it's a very well super well constructed movie, and you know, it's kind of amazing that it's as kind of clear as it is, considering, I mean, this is a movie that is basically introducing an entire wing of, you know, the Marvel Comics universe.
Yeah.
We've basically never seen before. Characters, planets, conflicts, races, you know, all this alien stuff that we've never seen. And it does it in a fairly effortless way. I mean, there's no way it's going to do it perfectly. And there are certainly, you know, like you say, characters and things that kind of get, you know, short shrift, but only in the sense that they're, you know, mentioned in an offhand way, or maybe they're not, you know, they don't get, like I said, the same kind of character moments or as much exploration as the core group. But I think that the smart thing that James Gunn and Nicole Perlman did in putting the movie together was that there really is this core group of characters that everything revolves, you know, the story kind of revolves around. And so as you kind of move away from them, there's still plenty of detail and plenty of characters and plenty of things to get, but just either by paying attention or by watching it multiple times or just kind of intuiting, you know, what's happening. But that kind of side stuff is just sort of a nice nod to fans, or is just kind of a nice bit of color to kind of give the universe more texture. But it really comes down to this, you know, these few characters and very kind of direct conflict and things, you know, it's kind of this mission that they're on, this goal that they have. It's pretty well established and pretty clear, which is why I think some of the recent backlash has kind of got me scratching my head, but maybe we'll talk about that.
I mean, no matter what, if there's a movie that's sort of universally praised, there's going to be backlash, and it's a bummer because I hadn't heard about much of it until today. And before today, I was thinking, like, oh, what a great way to sort of couch our discussion on Guardians of the Galaxy by saying, finally, here's this comic book movie, here's this summer movie, whatever, that doesn't seem to be polarizing. That, you know, there are certainly people who are being hyperbolic about it, but at least it's just a movie that everybody seems to like. Everybody's kind of entertained by it. Everyone's like, hey, this is fun. It's not this argument over best ever, worst ever, which has happened, you know, with several of these big movies in the last couple of years. And so it's unfortunate that seems to be starting. I don't think to the degree that it did with, you know, Man of Steel or Dark Knight Rises or even Avengers. But yeah, I mean, I knew it was coming because, you know, it can't just be a movie that's beloved by everybody. I know it doesn't work for everybody, but, I would hate to see the backlash make the movie kind of polarizing in a way that has bummed me out.
Yeah, I don't think it'll necessarily be the case. It seems like, you know, that maybe the worst of the backlash is I didn't like it, but
right.
Most of it seems to be I had a lot of fun, but and that's not too bad, you know, in the grand scheme.
No,
of things,
not at all.
You know, I had fun, I enjoyed it, but you know, it felt like something I'd seen before, or I didn't follow it, or there's too much going on, or you know, that kind of stuff. You know, which are, you know, I mean, that's your experience seeing a movie. And I, you know, we've talked about this before. Like if you go into a movie and you really enjoy it, then a lot of the little, you know, nitpick and niggly stuff doesn't really bother you. Or you find a way to explain it away, or you don't see it or whatever it is. And if you go in and it doesn't have you totally captivated, then, you know, you're going to see some of those things maybe a bit more. So I don't know. It's not, it's definitely not as bad. You know, this is no Dark Knight Rises or Man of Steel when it comes to, you know.
People arguing on the internet.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, and what you had said definitely makes me want to see it again, because you had said on your first viewing that you felt like maybe it was a little overstuffed or unwieldy, and those are definitely some of my reservations, that I did feel a little bit of that. You know, I felt like the Nova Corps kind of gets thrown in there, but we don't totally understand who they are, what they do. I think the movie has kind of a villain problem, but that's true of almost all the Marvel movies. And again, I can say that the things it goes back to, I want to say it was Film Crit Hulk said something about the Avengers once, like, yes, the Avengers has problems, but it works in all the ways that it needs to work. And so you forgive the problems. And for me, that's true of Guardians of the Galaxy, that while I feel like the villains aren't as strong as they might have been, as strong as the hero characters, as strong as I've seen in a very small handful of other superhero movies, and by that I mean very small, it kind of doesn't matter, because who I'm really there for, you know, are the Guardians themselves, and they are so well drawn, and there's so much care and joy put into bringing them to the screen that I don't care if Ronan the Accuser is maybe not the most well-developed character. And I will say, too, that I've never really had an interest. Like, I was not very familiar with the Guardians of the Galaxy as a comic prior to this movie being announced. Once it was announced, it was on my radar a little bit more. I read a few issues, not of the original run, but of the sort of the rebooted run from a few years ago. I knew who Rocket Raccoon was, and that was sort of it. Even that was from my official handbook to the Marvel Universe. The cosmic side of the Marvel Universe has always been of the least interest to me. Like, I've read Infinity Gauntlet. I don't love it. Just the cosmic stuff doesn't interest me that much. The sort of ground level stuff has always been what I'm into. But based just on this movie, and this is obviously I'm jumping to a big conclusion or I'm overstating. Based just on this movie, I'm way more interested in the movie cosmic stuff than I am in the ground level stuff. Because I was already thinking about, you know, they're already talking about the inevitable Guardians of the Galaxy Avengers crossover. And while that's great in theory, my immediate thought is, no, keep them separate. I just want to stay with these guys in space. I don't need to see them go down to New York. And again, that could change, you know, as the ground level movies change, or if I don't like Guardians of the Galaxy 2 or something, but I really had fun. And some of that, I don't know. I worried because we were seeing it at the Alamo Drafthouse, and I was so excited to finally go to that theater that I worried that that experience was going to distract me or overwhelm me from really enjoying the movie. And in some ways, it actually worked, I think, to the movie's advantage, because one of the things they do there is prior to the movie, they have some kind of pre-programming that's specially fitted for the feature that they're showing. So you got about a half hour of different, a lot of like raccoon videos of like raccoons rooting around in the garbage, a raccoon song, a raccoon cartoon. Then they would, you know, intercut that with the trailer for Ice Pirates, or the trailer for Galaxy Quest, not Galaxy Quest, oh my gosh, Star Crash. And I love both of those movies, so they're speaking my language right there. Did you ever see the specials?
No, it sounds kind of familiar, but no.
It's a movie that James Gunn wrote. It might have been the first thing he wrote post-Troma, so it was pre-Scooby-Doo, pre-Dawn of the Dead. And I think the movie didn't turn out the way that he had hoped. It came out in maybe 99 or 2000, around the same time as Mystery Men, and it's a very similar kind of a movie. It's about a superhero team that is breaking up, basically. You never really see them fight crime. You just see them in their day-to-day lives. But there's a great sort of fake commercial for the Specials action figures that's in the movie. And so they showed that little fake commercial. So they did all these things to sort of not only get you excited about Guardians of the Galaxy, but also to kind of contextualize it in this way. Like, these are the things that James Gunn is drawing inspiration from. These are the kinds of movies that he's kind of riffing on. And in that way, it almost made it more fun. You know, it wasn't like they just showed a bunch of science fiction trailers for movies that were like dark or dour. I mean, they were showing really kind of fun, upbeat, sometimes silly science fiction movies, and that's what Guardians of the Galaxy is.
Yeah, I mean, I think it isn't quite the same thing, but I mean, I was listening to the soundtrack, like you said, pretty much or nonstop that week before, and I was worried that that was going to distract me in some way, or I'd kind of already be tired of the songs by the time the movie started. But I think it really kind of primed me in a way I wasn't expecting for, so that I was already kind of in the you know, the tonal mindset of what the movie was going for,
right?
Because the music is so important. You know, I think one of the reasons why it works as well as it does, you know, is because, you know, like you, I'd never read the Guardians of the Galaxy comics growing up, because there really weren't any Guardians of the Galaxy comics until like the mid 2000s. So you have this kind of relatively new property that's very unique, that, you know, exists in a corner of the comic book world that most people aren't familiar with, but is a lot of fun. You know, I mean, obviously you have a, you know, spacecraft and planets and aliens, and that kind of movie is something we've seen before. So there's a certain amount of familiarity. But then you have James Gunn, who kind of, you know, takes the movie and and draws kind of B-movie inspirations. For it has kind of a B-movie feel, even though it's such a big blockbuster.
Right.
And that, I think that works so well because it fits, you know, the characters and the story and the sense of humor and all this stuff to kind of create something that, it's hard to, I mean, that is fun in a way that's uncynical, that, you know, that isn't just about, you know, these, you know, yes, it's about, you know, someone trying to destroy things, but it's not really. It's about, you know, this band of misfits that's trying to kind of, you know, save the world, but also kind of survive each other and have fun along the way. So it's, I don't know, it's got this kind of B-movie vibe that I really like. And even in the special effects, which, you know, maybe aren't the greatest, you know, CGI-wise coming off of something like, you know, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. But at the same time, that also fits the kind of the B-movie aesthetic. You know, there's one shot where Drax, you know, rips this robot drone in two, and you can almost feel the green screen in that.
Right.
And it's like, okay, that's, you know, maybe that's bad, you know, CGI work or, you know, not great, but that works. Like it fits the movie at the same time. I'm totally okay with it.
And then there were other aspects of it that I felt like, because he did go maybe more practical, that, like you said, it sort of speaks to kind of an old school, B movie vibe. Just the fact again that you have Zoe Saldana and Michael Rooker and Dave Bautista, you know, clearly in makeup, not being necessarily enhanced by CGI. I mean, Rocket mm-hmm. and Groot and Thanos are all CG characters, and Thanos to me was the most distracting of all the CG characters. I felt like that almost got thrown in after the fact, and maybe someday we'll find out that it did. But I like the fact, you know, especially Michael Rooker has a sort of, you know, an odd appearance, but it's very clearly, oh, hey, there's Michael Rooker in makeup. And I love that, you know, that's how it would have been done in 1982 or whatever. And so I thought that was really cool. And I felt like certain things, locations, whether it be the prison set or even sometimes his ship, which I didn't know until after the fact when I think I saw it on Twitter, that it's named after Alyssa Milano.
Yeah, no, that's so great.
That things have weight to them, and you can kind of feel them banging around into each other in space, you know, that it has that kind of a vibe where not everything is pristine and clean in the way that, like, Lucas's Star Wars prequels are. But it's also not this dark, oppressive kind of Blade Runner future where everything is dingy and banged up in a way to suggest, you know, misery. It just felt lived in, which is hard to do in science fiction.
Yeah, I mean, the movie walks such a fine line and does it so well of kind of balancing these things you wouldn't think you could kind of keep in balance in a movie. I mean, it's great that it's made as much money as it is, and it's been such a hit. And it was really weird for me on Friday night to go and see as many kids in the theater as I saw. And I thought, well, this may be not totally appropriate. Right. I don't know. Maybe it's not appropriate for kids, but at the same time, it's become this, like, let's bring the kids to the movie, you know, experience. And for the kids who get to see it, that's awesome. But, you know, it has this kind of popular appeal with these characters that no one's heard of. It's, you know, it's this big budget, you know, CG, you know, blockbuster that feels like a B movie. You know, it's this, you know, it's, I don't know, it's all these things that he's able to kind of keep in balance somehow and be both things, be kind of both at the same time. I'm not exactly sure how he pulled it off. I don't know how much of it is just people being ready for this type of movie. You know, I don't know how much the audience response, you know, is can be credited for some of that kind of for that success, or just kind of the way it's kind of staying together. But it's just a weird movie. You know, it feels unique, but it also feels familiar. That's like some of the criticisms are coming from. Oh, I've seen this before, but you haven't really. I mean, you've never seen this
right.
Before.
Well, right. And that's part of the movie's charm is that it does. It's a new combination of familiar elements, you know, because, yeah, he's definitely pulling from a lot of familiar sources, and the story isn't necessarily something he's not reinventing, the hero's journey or anything like that. But to me, it felt like I do this column semi-infrequently at fthismovie.net called It Came from the 80s, which is about a very specific kind of movie that only existed in the 1980s when genre kind of first became really popular in the wake of Star Wars. And we got a lot of science fiction, a lot of fantasy. And as a kid who grew up with cable, those were a lot of the movies that I grew up on. And they range from the big budget Hollywood versions to crazy weird things that came from Italy or whatever. But because of the proliferation of, you know, VHS and cable TV, you had access to all these weird movies. But there's a very specific kind of energy to those movies that's what this felt like to me. This movie felt like the kind of 80s movie that I grew up watching. And I mean that actually as sort of the highest compliment, because I think I would have thought that kind of thing was impossible to do anymore. I just think our filmmaking tastes have changed so much. Our cultural climate is so different now. You know, I would have thought it would be very difficult or impossible to get back to that kind of a place, but I really felt like this movie did it.
I mean, it's kind of the anti, you know, gritty, realistic superhero movie that we've kind of been moving toward, at least in maybe the DC movies. I mean, it's kind of the anti-Nolan movie in a lot of ways, because it's just about being, it's not about whether things make sense. It's not about whether, you know, everyone's powers and, you know, come from a, you know, this place of believability. It's not about, you know, these complicated backstories. It's just about, hey, let's have an adventure.
Right.
And at the same time, get to know these characters, you know, not just on a superficial way, but, you know, you get enough information about all these characters, I think, to kind of understand where they come from, to kind of see, you know, real, you know, clear, you know, thematic things that he's dealing with. It's not just a lot of fun. You know, it's not just this big whiz bang action thing. Like, boy, wasn't that a fun roller coaster ride? I think there's a lot you can get out of it. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of heart and a lot of, you know, depth to what he's doing in a very kind of quick and efficient way. Maybe some of it's kind of shorthand, but I think it works pretty well.
Yeah. I think he gets to some really strong character beats right off the bat. And we'll get into spoilers shortly, but I mean, the very first scene of the movie it involves a child saying goodbye to his mother, and it's very sort of emotional in a way. And it's not necessarily what you're expecting coming into this goofy, colorful space opera. But he finds a few of those beats throughout the movie to sort of ground it, not in the way that we're talking about with like gritty realism, but ground it in some sort of emotional connection that we have to the characters to remind us that there are things at stake beyond just, you know, the fate of the universe, which we know is going to be okay because that's the movie, you know. But there are sort of emotions and characters that are at stake.
And those moments aren't just, you know, emotionally manipulative or something. They inform the characters and they have direct consequences that lead to the cool action stuff that we see later on.
Right. Definitely. There's one actually that I want to single out when we get into spoilers, cause it's not one that I've heard talked about yet. And again, I was avoiding reviews going into it. I really haven't gone back and read a bunch of them, mostly because I wanted us to have our own conversation. I didn't want to be, you know, spitting out things that I had read from other people. It's interesting that just a few months ago you had talked about sort of the Christopher Nolan gritty, more realistic superhero movie. I mean, just a few months ago, Marvel put out Captain America: The Winter Soldier, which is certainly kind of splashy and fun, but is definitely more informed by a kind of 70s paranoid political thriller that is much more sort of the gritty, realistic school than something like this. So it's amazing that in a matter of months we could get such wildly different takes on sort of the superhero movie. And I like that, you know, I like that we're at a place now, because there are times where I feel burned out by this comic book superhero genre, because there's times where I just feel like we're seeing the same movie over and over again, or they just keep announcing the next one before this one's even out. And it's like, oh, can we just talk about something else? Can we see something that doesn't have a guy in a costume? And I say that as somebody who likes these movies. So there are times when I feel burned out, but then when you think about how both of these, you know, Captain America the Winter Soldier and Guardians of the Galaxy both fall under this category of comic book movie or superhero movie or even Marvel movie, if you want to be more specific, but really are so wildly different and belong to completely different genres, even though they both fall under that banner, I'm happy to see that, you know, that comic book movie isn't necessarily the defining genre. You know, it's sort of a category, but it's not necessarily going to be the genre itself.
Yeah, and this, I could be wrong. This feels like the first Marvel movie to kind of push beyond the template that was, the character template that was established from the beginning. And you have the phase one that was all leading up to the Avengers getting together. And then after that, we had another Iron Man movie, another Thor movie, another Captain America movie. So still in that world, still with those characters, this is the first one that feels like they're pushing in a slightly different direction and expanding the universe. I mean, like, literally, they're expanding the universe in going into the universe. But, I mean, this movie feels, you know, it feels like the next Marvel movie, but it also feels like a spinoff in some ways. I mean,
it is.
This gives me some hope and maybe some excitement for, you know, I think what people have poo-pooed in, like, the idea of, like, Star Wars spinoff movies, or the whole thing of, like, all these spinoff movies are going to start to come out in addition to these main franchise things. And there's room, maybe, with a spinoff movie or with something that's a little bit more standalone to have fun, to not be so tied to what's come before. I mean, Guardians obviously has, you know, threads that'll move into the future story and that tie into the larger Marvel universe. But at the same time, it's not beholden to, we got to set this thing up for the next Avengers. I mean, Thanos maybe is kind of like that. But other than that, there's not a whole lot. Other than that, and I guess the central MacGuffin, which is a word I've heard more in the past 5 days than ever in my entire life.
Oh, really?
But people keep talking about it. I guess you haven't been, you know, reading stuff.
No. Oh, that's interesting.
Good for you.
Yeah, because, right.
I mean, it's become this, you know. Yeah, it's become this kind of rallying cry on both sides. But anyway.
Well, that's why I'm a little bit I'm sure, you know, some of this is just that I'm kind of buzzing off the fun of this movie. But I'm dreading a little bit when it does have to get pulled into the larger Marvel universe.
Sure.
When it does, you know, when the Guardians of the Galaxy show up in Avengers 3 in 9 years or whenever that comes to pass, you know, because I like that. You know, I think part of what this movie has going for it is that it does exist independently of all this other stuff. And I would argue that the worst scene in the movie is the one that has to do that job of tying it into the larger mythology. Mm-hmm. And we can't talk about that without getting into spoilers, which we'll do in just a minute. But that was the moment where it felt like Iron Man 2, where it's like, oh, we got to stop the movie in order to tie it into the Marvel universe. And it's like, no, just let this movie be its thing. Let us, you know, get to know these characters, fall in love with these characters, let James Gunn establish his world and just do what he wants with it. And then, you know, if or when it works, then worry about, okay, how are we going to pull this together? Again, I appreciate the fact that they're, you know, playing the long game and they're really looking ahead and how are we going to tie all this together, because the Avengers wouldn't have been possible if they weren't doing that. But I don't want to see it happen to the detriment of a movie that I'm otherwise really liking.
Right.
And this is the last thing I'll say before we move into spoilers, is just, there was a lot of talk before the movie came out that this movie was a big gamble because, like you said, it's based on a comic book that not a lot of people know about. It's this kind of goofy space opera, which really hasn't been done in a long time. It's so rewarding to see, you know, I wouldn't argue that the movie isn't necessarily totally revolutionary or anything, but it does take a lot of little to medium-sized gambles. Not just, you know, playing in this corner of space or making a movie from a comic book property that doesn't have necessarily huge brand name recognition. But it's rewarding to see all of those gambles pay off, particularly the hiring of James Gunn, again, as somebody who's been a big fan. I mean, I even watched that season of VH1's Scream Queens just because he was a judge on it. So the hiring of James Gunn to write and direct this huge property, the casting of Chris Pratt, who was no one's idea of a leading man in a science fiction movie, because at the time he was just Andy Dwyer on Parks and Recreation. The casting of Dave Bautista as Drax the Destroyer. And I remember at the time, Jason Momoa was possibly going to play the part. And I was so excited about that. And then I was so disheartened when he didn't do it. He's instead going to play Aquaman in the Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. But I thought he was great. Just a weird, eclectic cast that's been thrown together, a talking tree, a talking raccoon. I mean, there's all these things that any one of them could have been a disaster, because you go back to, let's say, 86, and they do Howard the Duck, and that movie just has the one thing that they have to make work, which is, you know, the talking duck, and they kind of failed there. So that this movie is able to do, you know, 15 different or 20 different talking ducks is no small feat.
It's really a reminder that, you know, filmmaking is such it's an art, not a science. And even the art of it is so kind of up in the air. I mean, any one thing can make a movie, you know, fall apart or not be as great as it is. And there's all these, it's this great combination of happy accidents and things that just happen to fall in just the right place, and people who believe in some idea maybe without knowing why. And it just kind of all comes together. I remember something in I think it was a supplemental features on some DVD of Casablanca I bought a long time ago. They basically said, you know, no one knew it was going to be a great movie before it came out. It was just all this stuff, and they kind of hoped it would be okay. And then once it all came together, you know, it kind of presented itself as being this masterpiece. And I'm not saying Guardians is the same thing, but at the same time, like, all these like weird little decisions that no one could have known were going to turn out as well as they did, just come together to gel into this movie that works. I think works all the way through, you know, minor flaws aside.
Yeah, right.
And it's kind of amazing that this movie exists in a world where everything is so kind of focus tested and commercialized to death, that just this kind of weird semi experimental blockbuster is as good as it is and is getting as much love as it is.
Yeah, and again, that's the crazy thing, is like, we live in a world where this movie totally can exist, and yet it's still surprising that it does, and that it's as good as it is, and like you said, that it's being as well received. And I don't know what, I mean, it had a great marketing campaign. I know it's having positive word of mouth, and I think it's the kind of movie that people are going to revisit a couple of times. So I suspect it's going to continue to do very well. Not that box office is necessarily, you know, an indicator of a movie's quality, but I'm happy to see it make a bunch of money, because you want good movies to do well in the hopes that, you know, they'll make more good movies. But I don't know what to attribute the success to. Again, it had a great trailer, and maybe it is just sort of an antidote. You know, last summer we were sort of besieged by destruction. There were so many movies that included scenes of the Earth being wiped out. Not the Earth, but cities being leveled and things destroyed. And this movie, while it does feature, you know, a scene or two of something comparable, it's in a very different spirit. There's a different emotional investment at stake. And maybe it is just that this movie felt like the antidote to last summer's kind of destruction porn. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a dour movie. It's not a cynical movie. It's not a negative movie. It's a very positive movie.
Yeah.
With some, you know, very purposeful edges on it, and some kind of like dark, funny stuff. But at the same time, like it is a movie that leaves you feeling really good about stuff, and not in a, you know, not just in that roller coaster, you know, manipulative sort of way. It actually earns, I think, that good feeling just for being, you know, a kind of a celebration. And I think that's what a lot of a lot of people mean when they say it's fun. I think it's yeah. It's fun not because it's just, you know, a lot of explosions and ooh, he just, you know, just got that guy, but in the sense that it, you know, it leaves you feeling good.
Yeah. Okay, let's move into spoilers. If you guys have not yet seen Guardians of the Galaxy, you should probably stop listening here and come back to us after you do see the movie. But obviously, we are both very much of the mind that you should see the movie, especially this weekend when Hollywood is really begging you to see Guardians of the Galaxy a first or second or third time by offering you Into the Storm, one of the most aggressively unpleasant-looking movies I've ever seen a trailer for. And, of course, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So vote with your dollars and go see Guardians of the Galaxy again. All right, so we're going to move into spoilers now. The scene that I was talking about, I'm assuming you figured out as being the worst scene in the movie, is the one where the movie stops cold so that Ronan can go see Thanos, as mm-hmm. played in motion capture by Josh Brolin. That scene didn't really work for me on any level. And again, I know that it's to keep this thread alive of Thanos as the main, you know, bad guy that's behind all of this. And eventually we're going to build up to him as the villain in Avengers 3. And we're going to do Infinity Gauntlet, I assume, because that's sort of now the running thread that's going through all these Marvel movies is his search for the Infinity Gems, which is sort of what this movie is vaguely about. I just didn't think it worked at all, and it really did to me feel like a scene that was inserted after the fact as a way of tying things together, even down to the special effects. I thought that the performance capture on Thanos was nowhere near as good as it was on Rocket Raccoon.
Yeah, I mean, I was okay with that scene. I mean, I've been reading not necessarily Guardians comics recently, but I've been reading just some stuff in the cosmic universe just to kind of get my footing, which is actually really helpful because there are things in this movie that are not directly from the comics, but are referenced, like the prison, the kiln prison, is a reference to at the edge of the galaxy. Prison/energy-producing colony called Kiln. A lot of little things like that. That was nice. And I just read some stuff with Thanos. So I was, you know, I was happy to see him because I was kind of in a Thanos-y sort of mood. I can see where you're coming from. I think that's, you know, it's a short scene. It's not like it, you know, grinds the movie to a halt for very long. But it does. It seems like it's there for fans. In the same way that the, you know, the Infinity Stone stuff and some of the little Easter eggs and the collector's, you know, lair,
right.
Are there just for people who love the comics to kind of say, ooh, I remember that, which has its place in these movies, certainly.
And I can't decide how I feel about the stuff with the collector because, again, I enjoy the kind of weird energy of it, and Benicio del Toro is giving a very eccentric performance. And so as a way of just being another part of what I had sort of described as this very lived-in universe, I don't mind it, you know, and I almost feel like if it was a different actor playing the same part, or if I didn't know that the collector was ultimately probably going to play a much larger role in all of this, it would bother me less. But as it stands, it to me felt like, again, something that was inserted in as a way of setting up something larger instead of just being allowed to stand on its own. So I come away from it feeling like, oh gosh, either don't have it at all or do more with it. And neither of those is necessarily fair because, like I said, on its face, it's okay. Because it is just another interesting little, you know, detail. And this movie is very much about, it's a movie where, you know, all of the corners have things going on. And that's one of the things that I like about it, that it's drawn all the way around.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Thanos scene is certainly more inconsequential.
Yeah.
Because it's about looking forward. I think the collector scene is more key to the plot.
Well, it certainly sets up what happens, you know, when you grab the stone, which is, you know, the climax of the film.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does that. It also, like watching it a second time.
Oh, there it is.
But I mean, that whole that whole thing where he's describing, you know, the history of the stones in a sort of little, you know, slideshow about you know, what they do.
Yeah.
Actually sets up exactly what happens at the end of the movie. He talks about, you know, the celestial being who wipes out the planet, which right. obviously foreshadows what Ronan wants to do. And then he shows, you know, he says, you know, that this group right. tried to harness the power by, you know, all holding it together, and they couldn't do it, which ends up being obviously what the Guardians do at the end of the movie.
Right.
So, you know, and I don't think any of that is like in your face that you're watching the first time thinking, oh, this is just, you know, they're just putting this in there so we know what to expect later. I think it's more kind of, it just gives you more, another little sliver of information about, you know, what the stakes are, what the power, you know, what the power of this object is, you know, what could happen, what else has been tried. Kind of, it gives you a little bit of history that informs what's going to happen. I think one of the strengths of the movie is that it just, it doesn't, there are some exposition dumps, although I think they're pretty quick. I think everything in this movie kind of happens pretty quickly and efficiently. But there, a lot of the information we're given that tells us how things work, who characters are, what their abilities are, what their ships could do, and their rocket boots and all this stuff. Everything is kind of just doled out in little moments that don't stop the action, but kind of just part of what's happening. You know, when we see, you know, that great, not the opening scene, but the great scene when Peter Quill goes and gets the orb to begin with, while he's listening to his Walkman and singing to "Come and Get Your Love." And, you know, we introduce the rocket boots by him, you know, jumping over that pit of snakes,
right?
And that comes back in almost immediately when he you know, escapes by kind of rocketing himself backwards through the hole, and then again when they have that fight scene on the. That's not a quad, you know, the plaza. That's the
yeah, one. Yeah.
And he sticks the rockets on Gamora and blasts her off. I mean, all that stuff is just sort of like, I don't know. It kind of, everything builds off of what's happened before. Like, it's not like, oh, they just stuck that in there. It's, oh, we saw something that tells us that that's a tool that he uses, or that's the way that he, you know, does what he does. I think that opening fight scene, you know, with all of them kind of chasing and trying to capture each other, is great because it gives us a lot of information about the characters and the way they fight, and kind of, you know, informs the characters through their actions and not just what they tell you about them.
Yeah, I thought that was a really neat way of setting everyone up and bringing them together. You know, I think maybe based on the trailers, I was expecting them to just be thrown in jail together, and that's sort of how they meet. But
yeah.
I like the fact that the movie brings them together before that, and at least everybody except for Drax, and has them all wanting different things,
mm-hmm.
while they all sort of are after the same thing, but it's all for different reasons. And this person's chasing this person, but this guy's chasing this guy. I want to quickly talk about two things. One, what I had called sort of the villain problem,
mm-hmm.
of the movie. And two, some of the issues that I had with Gamora. And maybe let's start there. Because while I feel like, you know, the movie gives you a lot of credit at times, it just introduces certain ideas without really going into a ton of explanation about it. You know, even the fact that Peter Quill's ship is the Milano, that he's sort of obsessed with the popular culture that existed before he was taken away from Earth. And so he's mm-hmm. sort of stuck in this bubble, you know, but his ship is decorated with it. He's listening to all the music. I mean, I love that detail. And the movie, with the exception of when he talks about the Walkman and the reason why he listens to the songs, the movie doesn't ever go out of its way to explain, like, oh no, he's you know, stuck on the pop culture from when he left, and this is why it's his connection to Earth, and blah 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 blah.
And I think that's a great way to take a lot of unfamiliar stuff and give audiences a way in.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think it's one of the things I really appreciate about you know, really good, like, science fiction or fantasy. I mean, something like, I don't know, like Harry Potter, for instance, I think works really well because J.K. Rowling takes things you already know and then gives them a twist.
Right.
Gives you a way into a world that has its own rules. I think I've read books where they just jump in and start giving you all this mythology that is just disconnected from anything other than the author's imagination, and it's very hard to find a way in. This isn't necessarily an analog, but at the same time, I think giving you that stuff gives you a little taste of Earth and the world that you know in this unfamiliar setting, which I think is really, really great.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It'll do that in ways that doesn't call attention to itself. And then at times I feel like it does some fairly clumsy exposition dumps, primarily with character motivations. I mean, most of them I feel like are handled okay. I didn't feel like they necessarily called attention to themselves, with the exception of Gamora, a character I really liked, a performance I really liked. I loved her scenes with Peter Quill. I thought they were a lot of fun together. My only issue with her character is I just feel like sometimes her motivations, it's like they got skipped over. She explains them all in kind of a heavy-handed way, but at the same time, I didn't find the explanation particularly satisfying, and it's sort of mirrored with Nebula, who is a great design. I almost felt like that character would have been better if she was the Boba Fett, if she just didn't speak, if she was just this terrifying badass assassin, because she's another character whose motivations don't always totally make sense, and people are very willing to switch allegiances and double cross, but I never felt like he was able to totally make that stuff work. It, just in terms of, you know, Gamora's sort of cover, that she hates Thanos and she's looking to take Thanos down, but she's sort of working for him. I mean, it's all explained, but it's never really felt. Does that make sense?
No, it does, absolutely. I think she's... We kind of meet her character kind of already in progress, and we never get a good starting point for her.
Right, maybe, I mean, that's what it is.
There's never I mean, we first encounter her, obviously, she's working with Ronan, and then she says that she wants to go and get the orb from Peter on Xandar, and that's basically the first time we meet her, and already she has decided. For, you know, in scenes that I guess we didn't see that preceded that, you know, that she was going to betray Ronan and betray Thanos. And there's a whole, I mean, I think this is probably where the connection to Thanos hurts the movie, maybe even more than the scene with Thanos, is that you have this idea that Gamora and Nebula are both Thanos's daughters. And there's some sibling rivalry, and there's, you know, a love-hate relationship, mostly hate. And it doesn't really pay off, in any way, except that it then further ties into kind of the idea of, you know, traumatic pasts and maybe, you know, abusive parents or, you know, whatever else. Everyone has this sort of, thing that screwed them up, in their past. Someone did something to them or something, you know, something happened that was very traumatic. Even their fight scene at the end, the fight scene between Gamora and Nebula, feels like they probably could or should have shot more, and then it just kind of ends abruptly.
Well, her gesture to save Nebula,
yeah,
doesn't make sense. It feels like it's there, you know, to rationalize her as the hero and Nebula as the villain. And I understand now it leaves the door open for Nebula to return. But because their relationship was kind of poor, I feel like their relationship to one another was not very well defined, and their relationship to Thanos was also sort of ill defined, with the exception of a little bit of like lip service. I never felt those connections, and had those things really clicked, I think that would have been a really kind of strong dynamic. Because you would see in Nebula, you know, here's the way Gamora could have gone. And would really give Nebula a stronger motivation. I mean, when she decides to just help out Ronan and betray Thanos, I mean, it doesn't totally make sense. It's just sort of where the script needs her to go.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely the suggestion that, you know, both Gamora and Nebula were, you know, essentially kind of tortured and molded into their final shapes by Thanos, who was their father, maybe in name only, and I was his only adopted father.
Right. More.
But, you know, the idea that, you know, that they're just another tool that he uses to, you know, enact his will in the universe, and they have no love for him, is, I think, an idea that's introduced and maybe works a little bit more if you have some kind of comic book history with
Sure.
With Thanos, I guess, especially. Yeah. I don't have any real backstory on either Nebula or Gamora from my comic book reading, but I think that's definitely, you know, the weakest part. I think it's a movie that tries to do a lot quickly, that relies a lot on kind of just small bits of information that are maybe repeated in a few key places throughout to kind of give you just enough to so you can kind of start to fill in the gaps in your mind, or kind of just accept it as part of the universe and give it some texture. But I think in that case, there's just not quite enough of that. I think right. it's where, you know, I think James Gunn was trying to kind of stretch everything as thin as possible to fit as much into the movie as he could. And I think for the most part, it works really well. I think that's the one part where, you know, it just kind of starts to stretch a little too thin and just starts to break.
And I think, you know, I'm maybe only getting, because it doesn't ruin the movie for me in any
no,
way.
Not at
and,
all.
And I'm maybe only getting hung up on it a little bit because I feel like had it really worked, had that kind of thing really clicked, I think it would have elevated the movie to the point where, well, that and one other thing, I think it would have elevated the movie to the point where we could start, you know, we're a little quick to throw the word masterpiece around, but I really think it would have kicked it up to like some next level shit. Mm-hmm. Had that dynamic worked, and then the next thing I want to talk about, which is the movie's villain problem, and it's not new to Guardians of the Galaxy. It really is true of almost all of the Marvel movies. I mean, Tom Hiddleston is very charismatic as Loki in Thor and Thor, the Dark World and the Avengers. But I don't find him a particularly compelling villain. He's a great character and really interesting. And Hiddleston gives a great performance, but in terms of a villain, in terms of what his plan is, none of that is particularly interesting to me. Again, it always just involves, I'm going to destroy the world. Ronan the Accuser, again, I feel like is halfway there. I like the design of the character. I don't have objections to Lee Pace's performance. I like how sort of committed to this idea Ronan is. But I feel like it stops. It's another thing that just is given sort of broad strokes, and then it stops short of having any real shading, maybe, for lack of a better word. You know, again, his motivation is to destroy the world, as is the motivation of every villain. But again, maybe with some more backstory, because it's suggested that Ronan is sort of damaged in the way that some of the Guardians are. It just might have been interesting to see him as a mirror image of them, as sort of two sides of the same coin. So there's a lot of things about him I like as a villain, but ultimately he feels kind of generic.
He works well enough for me. I mean, okay. I think that he's basically what I think you think the Mandarin is at the beginning of Iron Man 3. Like I think both characters say fairly early on when you meet them that some people call them a terrorist. I think Ronan actually says that in his opening monologue as he's getting, you know, drained out of his pool of blackness and then dusted up and ready to go. So he is just this kind of like terrorist religious fanatic. I mean, he's really kind of just a madman, which is okay. I mean, it's okay. Like, I mean, it gives you this sense of this kind of unstoppable force, someone you can't reason with, someone you can't, you know, you can only try to defeat, you know, that's very powerful and becomes even more powerful once he gets the Infinity Stone. I think it's okay because he works in the way that they react to him and the way they ultimately, take him on and defeat him. I think works. I don't know. I can't describe it a better way than that. I love the idea, you know, talking about Ronan as just this sort of thing that they have to deal with. I love the fact that there's a major action scene in the middle of the movie that happens because Drax drunk dials him.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's
sure.
Just, it's all kind of about how these characters are relating to this object that they didn't, you know, that they kind of has fallen into their laps and they didn't know what it was. And kind of this other person who wants it and is not going to stop until he gets it. And how do they deal with it? I I don't know. If he was a little more subtle, I'm not sure it would have quite the same stakes. I absolutely understand that, you know, it's once again, it's a guy who wants to destroy the world. Although in this case, it's a world.
Right. It's a very specific world. It's not everything.
Let's not be worldist. All right? It's not the Earth. It's Xandar.
And he's certainly an intimidating physical presence. And when he is almost like the sort of the T-1000, just this unstoppable shark, I think that's when the movie works best. But it tries to kind of have it both ways, in that he's both the, you know, Thanos's muscle, and that's, I think he works well in that way. But then it also tries to pull him back and kind of make him the hands-off mastermind. And I think the combination of the two doesn't quite work for me. Like, I would want to see him be one or the other. I happen to like him better as the shark.
Yes. And he is. I mean, I think you're absolutely kind of right. He's kind of like Jaws. I mean,
right.
You see him. I mean, he's just this unstoppable force that is just going to keep coming until you blow him up.
Right. And even then, it doesn't work.
Right.
You have to.
Until it does.
You have to shoot him with your Infinity Stone power.
You do.
I love, too, the fact, again, it's not a major drawback of the movie, because in the same way that I had said a couple weeks ago when we talked about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, like, yeah, the human characters are underdeveloped. But I didn't mind it as much because the apes are so compelling that I'm able to get through the movie. And that's true of this movie as well. Yes, the villains are underdeveloped, but that's okay for me. Does it keep it from being like a truly, truly all-time great movie? Maybe. I don't know. But it's okay for me. Because again, it's the Guardians movie, and they are so great and well drawn and well played by the actors that it doesn't bother me as much.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things where, like, I think it'd be great if we had more color, or more shading, more nuance in Gamora's character and her backstory, because she's an integral part of the team. I think for Ronan, trying to kind of flesh him out a bit more might have kind of pushed the movie too far in the overstuffed category.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, this is a movie that's just sort of kind of holding a lot of things kind of in balance at any one point in time, and just spinning a lot of, you know, informational and character plates. And it's still kind of amazing that they all stay up as well as they do. Even if a few of them, you know, aren't, even if a few fall and break on the stage of life, I don't know.
But I think it's the kind of thing, too, where, you know, if a movie's only about 50% of the way there, you're just like, well, that was a miss, because it has such a far way to go to truly be great. But when a movie's 90% of the way there, sometimes that other 10% irks you, you know, in a way, because you're just like, oh, if you'd just done this and this, I think we'd be talking about a completely different movie. Again, said as someone who really enjoyed this movie.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I think that there's a dangerous tendency now for people to want to chase the idea of a perfect movie.
Oh, sure.
And, I know you agree with that. And you know, this is not a perfect movie, because there are virtually no perfect movies.
Exactly.
I mean, there are a few, very few, that really just hold up beginning to end.
Cuffs being one.
Absolutely. I mean, number one, I think. That's what that beat out Vertigo, didn't it, last year, is the number one movie?
AFI, yeah. I was surprised they went Cuffs, and yet not surprised.
I think this is just a movie that is kind of revels in the fact that, you know, movie making is kind of messy, and sometimes what you end up with is really, really great, despite all the things that could have happened, you know, could have gone in any other direction.
Sure.
And it's so hard to kind of look at this movie apart from, you know, the buzz that I'm feeling from watching it only a few days ago, and just the fact that people are still talking about it online, and it has this sort of, you know, mass, appeal at the moment. Once that fades, I think it'll still hold up. I mean, if you're talking about something like, you know, last year, The World's End was a movie that I think caught me at a very similar time, came out the same time of year, something I was really looking forward to, something that I grew to appreciate, once I saw it more than that first time, even something that, you know, the soundtrack was hugely important to me. But that's a movie that almost no one saw. And so there wasn't this kind of big conversation about it,
right?
Beyond like the film, film circles. This is a movie that is, that you know, people are going back to see with their kids, and it's becoming this big thing, and everyone loves Dancing Groot, and it's this kind of this big kind of joyous. You know, we haven't even talked about like Rocket or Groot barely.
No, we need to.
We have. There's so many great things about this movie. We haven't even talked about how funny it is. I mean, I find it, you know, hilarious, and I laughed at the same jokes, you know, two nights in a row, partly because it just sucks you in, and you're having so much fun watching it that, you know, you laugh at the things that are supposed to be funny, although I think it is genuinely funny as well. There's just so much going on in this movie that is just so good.
It is really funny. Again, it has great character dynamics, and that, I mean, the moment where Groot beats the shit out of like those four guys and it goes on and on and on, and you think that sort of that's the joke, that it's Sideshow Bob stepping on the rakes, you know, the how long it goes is so funny. And then the button that James Gunn puts on it is the way that Groot turns, you know, to the camera and smiles, the most like adorable, warm smile, for me was like, I mean, that kind of rivaled that great moment in the Avengers when Loki starts talking and Hulk just starts beating the shit out. I mean, just such a great moment, and really kind of takes you by surprise by sort of playing with what you expect. And this moment did that same thing for me. I love the way that James Gunn is constantly trying to subvert the hero moments. Yeah. And, you know, and those are only possible because this movie comes after six or eight or however many other Marvel movies where we are used to the beats and we're used to the tropes and we're used to some of the imagery. And so he's willing to take that and mess with it, whether it's the scene where Chris Pratt rescues Gamora and starts talking about it, and then it just turns into a weird self-serving thing about how impressed he is with himself,
yeah.
Or whether it's that great scene of them walking in slow motion after they've been sort of deemed the Guardians of the Universe, of the galaxy, rather. You know, it's that shot from The Right Stuff and Armageddon in every movie. And then, you know, to the left of the screen is Gamora yawning as they walk. I mean, it's, and you know,
I might've missed that cause I was watching Rocket, you know, adjust his crotch.
Yeah. Right. No, Gamora is straight up yawning, which I love.
Right.
And they've been doing that since the trailer, you know, and there were scenes in the trailer that were not in the movie that they shot specifically to give people an idea of what kind of movie this is, where it introduces the characters. And in the trailer, it has a character say, "What a bunch of a-holes."
Right.
That's how it's left. That's how you're introduced to the Guardians of the Galaxy in the movie's marketing. And for once, you know, the marketing accurately reflects the movie that you go to see, because the movie is constantly doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of great moments. I mean, obviously, there's a whole kind of big push at the end about how they realize that they're, you know, they're family and they're friends and they haven't never had friends before. And there's a scene where Drax is saying, you know, "You're my friend, and you're my friend." And Gamora, "Even though you're a whore, you're just like, don't you even start." I mean, it's like that kind of thing where he's being super sincere, and like it does kind of tie into the sort of central thematic idea of the movie. And it is sweet. At the same time, it's, you know, super hilarious. Or when they all, you know, decide to kind of stand up together and fight, and, you know, Rocket, you know, "Great, we're all standing up now. You're happy? We're all standing up now like a bunch of jackasses."
I was a little not concerned when they announced Bradley Cooper as Rocket's voice. Maybe I just was like, that just doesn't seem like an inspired choice. And so much else about what was announced with the movie, from the director to the lead, so much of what I was hearing was like, wow, that is inspired. And so when I heard Bradley Cooper, it just wasn't what immediately came to mind. But, I mean, I was, you know, wrong. He does a great job, and the character, obviously, I won't say he steals the movie, because everybody's so good that, mm-hmm. I mean, you could almost name anyone as your favorite, and I would say, yeah, oh, I could totally see that. And that's unbelievable, because in another version of this movie, I mean, Rocket walks away with the movie. He's this hilarious talking raccoon who gets to be sarcastic and funny and tough and kind of smartassy, and he should be sort of the runaway character. But again, it's to the movie's credit and to the credit of all of the actors that they're all so good and they're all so fun that any one of them, realistically, you could argue steals the movie.
I feel like I've heard people, different people, say that, you know, each one of the characters steals the movie for them. I mean, you can, you know, obviously Rocket, great, Groot in those moments. You know, he has three words that he says, and yet he's super hilarious. Although
technically he has five words.
He does.
Because he does. Absolutely we does. Are.
Which is a pretty great moment.
It is a great moment. And again, to the movie's credit, it does have moments like that where it is genuinely kind of moving and touching, and you realize how much you care about these characters, how much you are invested in their relationships, and when Rocket is crying because Groot is dead, I mean, you're genuinely upset. There's a moment, and I had kind of referenced it earlier, that I found very, I don't know if moving, it happens so quickly, and I don't know how to pronounce his name, and so I apologize, but he's Sean's roommate in Shaun of the Dead, Peter
Serafinowicz.
Serafinowicz, and he was on that show that you reviewed.
Spaced?
No, he was on Spaced, which I loved. Wasn't he on another kind of like British sketch comedy show?
Oh, Look Around You?
That's what it was, yeah.
I think it was, yeah. He was one of the. He's also actually the voice of Darth Maul.
I know.
That too, yeah.
So
you know everything, don't you, Patrick?
Just about The Phantom Menace. He has a moment when the Nova Corps, you know, forms their net around Ronan's ship, which is a cool moment and a cool visual. And then the ship starts to break the net and a bunch of the pilots are killed. And in the second before he is killed, he just yells out, "Rocket," in this way that is very human, where he's, you know, afraid. And that rang so true to me. But I also loved the fact that in that moment he was acknowledging Rocket as an equal. Because for the whole movie, it's set up, you know, that he kind of looks down on all the Guardians of the Galaxy. He thinks they're fuck-ups. And obviously, you know, people are constantly calling Rocket a rodent and a critter and just sort of looking down on him because he is a raccoon. But in that moment, he was looking to Rocket to help, to save him. He was looking at him as an equal. And I found that very moving.
Yeah, I think that I actually called attention to that moment, too, when I watched it. Because, I mean, you had this thing where, you know, this character that we've seen, who's not, you know, not a main character, but someone we recognize, you know, is about to die. And he calls out to Rocket. And for a second, I thought, oh, they're going to find some way to save him. They're not going to go there. And then, you know, he dies. And not only does Peter Serafinowicz have that great moment, but then it cuts to a shot of Rocket looking genuinely distraught.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, which, you know, for a CGI character, you know, is no small feat.
And then a CGI character who previously had no use for humanity, you know?
Absolutely. And then that kind of leads him to, lead the charge that ends up, taking out Ronan for the time being. Another moment that was such a small thing, but I loved it. I mean, you had the shot of all of these Andarians running away from the ships as they're falling down. And there's one that's about to fall down and this mother and child, and then Rocket comes in and, saves them. And then later on we find out that they're John C. Reilly's family. In just a very quick,
I don't think I put that together.
Yeah. I mean, I it was such a thing. Like you saw that, and I thought
it was odd that they specifically held on his wife and kid because they were that sort of pink alien. Are they Xandarians? What are they?
I don't know.
The pink aliens who we see throughout the movie. Yeah. I thought it was weird, but I thought it was just a way of. I thought it was just the movie saying like. This is a happy world where people don't, you know, see color because obviously not color, pink. You know what I mean? That
I do know what you mean.
That species are getting along and marrying with it because it flies in the face of Ronan's philosophy. You know what I mean? That the fact that they were married is directly antithetical to everything that Ronan was trying to accomplish. And so I thought that's what that was there for, but I didn't realize they were the family that Rocket saved.
Honestly, I think it's there for both. I mean, because it's not like they, you know, it's not a moment of, hey, that's that Spider-Man or whatever the line is.
That's the Spider-Man that saved my kid.
Exactly. They don't have that. All they have, you know, is a very human moment where John C. Reilly says, you know, basically, you know, you saved my family. And, you know, anyone living on that planet could say the exact same thing.
Right.
And then it ends up being that Rocket literally saved his family. He didn't know that. I mean, I'm sure, you know, he didn't know that. I mean, it was just this – they happened – they were just doing what they did. And they happen to, you know, save people who happen to be his family. And that I found that to be, you know, just such a nice little moment that I'm sure a lot of people, you know, missed. It happened so quick that it was just, you know, one of those things I sort of just caught on to, and they don't call special attention to it. They don't really push it down your, you know, throat. It's just a nice little, you know, moment. And I think it's a movie with a lot of those little moments that give the audience credit to pay attention, to kind of maybe get something or not get something. And there's a lot of things in there that are just there either for fun or just to add a little bit of color or something like that, where it's certainly not crucial to kind of understanding the emotional impact of, you know, John C. Reilly reuniting with his family after, you know, what could have been, you know, the worst day ever. But it just kind of adds a little bit something extra to the world. So,
okay, you've convinced me. I'll go see it again.
I think, I don't know. Look.
I was excited that during the jail scene, mm-hmm. there's a quick cameo from Lloyd Kaufman. And again, I just, as somebody who's been a trauma fan for a long time, I have to appreciate James Gunn staying true to himself and giving Lloyd Kaufman a cameo in this Marvel summer blockbuster, you know, owned by Disney. And here's the guy who made the Toxic Avenger getting a shout out in his movie. And again, there's all those little James Gunn touches, even in the casting, whether it's Michael Rooker, Nathan Fillion shows up sort of unrecognizable in the prison. And I noticed during the credits, though I didn't notice it during the movie itself, that Rob Zombie was like the voice of the prison.
No, I think it was the voice of the
voice of the Ravager.
The voice
of the ship. Yeah.
Oh, was he the ship? Okay. I don't remember there being any voices of the ship the second time I watched it, because I saw it the first time and I was like, I don't remember him or a navigator. I thought maybe they just replaced someone else's voice, but it must have been the ship. I just didn't catch it. Maybe. But yeah, no, that's great. You know,
which is now the second James Gunn movie in a row that Rob Zombie plays a voice, right? Because right, isn't he the voice of
the voice of God?
God speaking super, to the
it's Rain
Bible
Wilson.
Man, or no, it's not Bible Man, but it's
to Rain Wilson when he's having the vision of
right.
God touching his brain.
Right. So I love that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a movie that's just full of joy. I mean, it's a movie that was made by people who had a lot of fun making it, who had a very specific kind of vision, who wanted to throw in a lot of little stuff, but also had a pretty clear vision of, you know, the main story they wanted to tell and the characters they wanted to introduce to everyone. And it's just one of those movies where you don't feel like anyone was there to collect a paycheck.
Right.
Everyone, you know, just really wanted to do their best, even, you know, with however much they had to work with. And some characters, you know, some people didn't have that much to do. I mean, Glenn Close is barely in the movie, but she still, you know, does a good job. She's still Glenn Close. John C. Reilly, not in the movie all that much. Peter Serafino, same thing, but they have a pretty, you know, recognized, you know, pretty important parts to play in the movie. And you can tell that they, you know, did everything they could with those parts that they had.
And it just adds to sort of the singularity of the movie.
Yes,
that the same movie that has the voice of Rob Zombie and Lloyd Kaufman and a talking raccoon also has a performance from Glenn Close. And you're just like, how are these things coexisting? Let's quickly, before we wrap up, let's talk about the post-credits little scene, stinger, yes, whatever you want to call it. Dancing Groot, obviously very popular. The credits go by, and this was spoiled for me prior to the movie.
Me too.
Nathan Rabin of The Dissolve had a Facebook post that said, see Howard the Duck's cameo, post-credits cameo in Guardians of the Galaxy. That was the headline.
Oh.
I would not have clicked through something that said, like, see the Guardians of the Galaxy post-credits stinger, because I would have wanted it to be a surprise. So the fact that it was sort of unavoidable, and I guess you could say, well, it was my fault for being on social media, you know, 3 days before a movie opened. But he had since deleted the post, I think, the following day, because I think a lot of people gave him a hard time about it.
Sure.
So I was disappointed that was spoiled for me. And I was very curious going into the movie to see what the reaction to that would be. And very surprised at how well received it was by my audience. And not to continually name drop the Alamo Drafthouse, but I wondered if that had something to do with it, because obviously that's going to cater to a specific, perhaps savvier movie audience. Had I gone to see it in the Chicago suburbs where I usually go see movies, would they have even known who that was? I don't know. It helps, obviously, that immediately after it says, you know, Howard the Duck created by. I don't know if that is James Gunn saying, or Marvel saying, hey, there's a Howard the Duck movie coming, or if it's just sort of a fun little, like, hey, look what else the collector has. But I thought it was great for two reasons. One, I thought it was great that James Gunn was kind of saying, like, yeah, I acknowledge that they made a movie of Howard the Duck, and it's considered one of the biggest disasters of all time, but that doesn't mean the character is off limits. It's all in how you do it. Mm-hmm. And that he was sort of redeeming that character, again, embracing, you know, the weirder side of the Marvel Universe. Because if they are going to do a Howard the Duck movie, you know, obviously he's kind of stuck doing Guardians of the Galaxy now, but he's the guy that should be doing a Howard the Duck movie. But also, because it did play into this element of surprise. And on the Captain America Winter Soldier podcast, I went on this rant with Mike and Adam Thaz about these post-credit scenes, because I just felt like I didn't understand their function, because they were always just showing us things we already knew. It's like, here's Thor's hammer, but we know there's a Thor movie coming out. Here's, you know, Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver, but we know that they're in Avengers 2 already, so there's no surprise there. And James Gunn clearly listens to our podcast, because he said, well, I'm going to stick something in that's a genuine surprise. It wasn't just tying us into, you know, Avengers 2 or whatever the next Marvel movie is going to be. It was a real surprise. It was bringing a character out. It was, you know, what I thought these post-credit scenes were sort of designed for, which was just to give us another little fun thing walking out of the theater and to reveal another corner of the Marvel Universe. And I thought it was really the best surprise. I mean, the Thanos reveal in Avengers was good, but really since that first Iron Man, when Nick Fury says, you know, have I told you about the Avengers initiative? This obviously isn't quite on par with that, because that's setting up an entire, you know, movie universe, but I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I didn't want to know what it was going to be. I wanted for once to go into a movie,
right,
not knowing what the
internet will not allow to be.
It's my own, again, my own damn fault for staying on Twitter on Friday afternoon, long after I knew that I should have.
What is wrong with people, all though?
It was a joke. There was a comedian who made a joke who basically said, you know, that, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy has one of the best.
Oh, it was Kumail Nanjiani.
Yes.
I saw it.
Don't duck out early. And I said, oh.
I saw it after I had seen the movie, and I was like, well, that's kind of clever. But I guess had I not seen the movie yet, that would have made me mad.
Yeah. And somewhere I had read some speculation that it might be Howard the Duck. I don't know why. I don't know how. It was a while ago. I think it was just someone just saying, wouldn't it be cool if it was Howard the Duck? But yeah. And so I was bummed for a little while. I was like, oh, I hope this doesn't, you know, affect me, you know, my mood going into the movie. And then as I realized, it's just the thing at the end of the movie. The movie is not going to be affected by this. And, you know, actually watching it, you know, it's so short. I mean, compared to some of the singers at the end, it was actually, you know, even, you know, more brief than most. I thought it worked well, and from what I've read, it really was just for fun. I don't there are no plans that they've announced of a Howard the Duck movie. It's just as a nice little nod. And watching it a second time, because I read something about it online while I was after I'd seen it the first time, in the scene when they go to the collector's lair, the first time you see the collector, if you look directly above him, Howard the Duck is clearly visible sitting sideways in a case, and he turns and looks at the camera just before it goes out of focus.
No way.
He's clear as day in that shot. You're just not looking at him because you're looking at Benicio del Toro.
That's fantastic.
It's amazing. That's great. I mean, that is just – that's great.
Well, and again, the movie is all about referencing different aspects of the Marvel Universe that have never been done in a movie before. So this does that. But it also sets up this idea that, like, there are other talking animals besides Rocket Raccoon. Yeah. So in some ways it actually does – tie into the movie at large. And I read after the fact that did you read who the voice was?
Was Seth Green?
Seth Green. Yeah. I don't know. That's just a piece of trivia. I don't know.
No, that's great. One more thing I thought of, funny moments that I don't know a lot of people caught on to. I love the moment when they're in the prison and Gamora is being dragged off to be murdered, and Chris Pratt gets up and follows her. And then Rocket sticks his head up. He's got, like, the bed head where half
Yeah.
I love that scene. I love that shot. I laughed both times. I think I was the only person that laughed in the theater. But
my theater cracked up at that. Again, lots of cool little details like that, and those are the kinds of things I think that keep you coming back to a movie over and over again.
I can't believe we've been talking for as long as basically the running time of the movie. And there's still so much we haven't talked about, but I guess we're just not going to be able to.
Well, hopefully, it's a movie that we'll be talking about again come the end of the year. Maybe, I don't know.
Maybe. Well, I could say I might.
It was certainly a lot of fun and satisfying again in that way that you want some of these summer spectacle movies to be. And right now, again, this is the most recent one I've seen, so it's always hard to frame it sort of within the larger context of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You had said that you don't often feel like revisiting a lot of Marvel movies. I, for some reason, have that same thing. I'm never like, oh, I'm going to throw on Iron Man or The Incredible Hulk or whatever, or even Avengers, like you said. After one viewing, which was just, 3 days ago, so that's not really fair, but this feels like a movie that I'll come back to a lot, again, because it does have that kind of throwback 80s B-movie vibe. It pushes a lot of buttons for me that I really like. And so that's why I would see, I'm not saying like I'll go back and watch it the most because it's the best Marvel movie. It's just because it's of a certain sensibility that I really respond to.
And I think this probably is my favorite Marvel movie because it is
might
so
be mine. I just don't even want to bother. Like,
I know, and
them,
and
you know?
See my problem is that pretty much ever since the first Captain America, I've said that every Marvel movie that I've seen in the theaters is the best one yet. So now I feel
and the rest of the internet.
Exactly. So now I feel kind of bad about saying it, even though I really think this is the best one yet.
Did you say Thor the Dark World was
I did
the best
not
one
see
yet?
No, no. I did not. I said movies I saw in the theater.
Oh, got it. Sorry.
I did not see Thor Dark World in the theater. I did not see either of the Thor movies in the theater, which I think says something about how I feel about the Thor movies. Yeah. And that's just my own interest in the character.
Right.
And I think someone else may say the Thor movies are the best because they love that character. This is the kind of comic book movie I want to see. One that is trying to do something a little bit different, that has its own tone and feeling, has a great sense of humor, great characters. I mean, this is a movie. I think like you just said, I mean, this is kind of a movie for me. This is the kind of movie I like to watch.
Yeah.
It has just the right mix of things in it. I'm totally with you that, the more I watch movies, the more I realize that characters who, I can not relate to, but characters I can enjoy and, spend some time with is way more important than whether an action scene is cool. Even though this movie has a lot of really cool action scenes.
It does.
I mean, you've got the prison break is awesome.
It is really awesome.
all this stuff, the final, the fight scene, the whole opening sequence on Morag's. I mean, so much good stuff.
And the movie has, no less than 5 great characters. And think of how many movies you've seen this year that have, 3, if that many. A lot of movies have 1, maybe 2. This has at least five, and then you can make an argument for others if you really respond to some of the other characters. But
I mean, I think we barely talked about Dave Bautista, and he's great in this movie.
We didn't even talk about Chris Pratt. That dude crushed it. He's so great. Yes, he is.
So good.
He's perfect.
So good.
Yeah. All right. Listen, we'll start.
So part two next week.
Sure. Yeah. I like it. I'm gonna already have to break this one up into three parts.
It's either that or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Listen. Next week's show is going to be on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but not the new one. We're going to actually be talking about the 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, so look for that. Thank you, Eric, so much for talking about this movie, and I apologize. Usually we like to have these new release podcasts out on Monday. This one had to wait a little bit because I was coming back from Austin, so I appreciate you waiting for me to talk about it.
I hope it was worth it.
It was totally worth it. This was a blast. And we will talk to you guys next week.